The Man Who Would Be King by Rudyard Kipling. Read by Richard Midgley. Brother to a prince and fellow to a beggar, if he be found worthy. The law, as quoted, lays down a fair conduct of life, and one not easy to follow. I have been fellow to a beggar again and again, under circumstances which prevented either of us finding out whether the other was worthy. I have still to be brother to a prince, though I once came near to kinship with what might have been a veritable king, and was promised the reversion of a kingdom, army, law court, revenue, and policy all complete. But today I greatly fear that my king is dead, but by intermediate, which is very awful indeed. There are no cushions in the intermediate class, and the population are either intermediate, which is Eurasian, or native, which for a long night journey is nasty, or loafer, which is amusing, though intoxicated. Intermediates do not buy from refreshment rooms. They carry their food in bundles and pots, and buy sweets from the native sweetmeat sellers, and drink the roadside water. That is why, in the hot weather, intermediates are taken out of the carriages dead, and in all weathers are most properly looked down upon. My particular intermediate happened to be empty till I reached Nazirabad, when a big black-browed gentleman in shirt-sleeves entered, and following the custom of intermediates, passed the time of day. He was a wanderer and a vagabond like myself, but with an educated taste for whisky. He told tales of things he had seen and done, of out-of-the-way corners of the empire into which he had penetrated, and of adventures in which he risked his life for a few days' food. "If India was filled with men like you and me, not knowing more than the crows where they get their next day's rations, it isn't 70 millions of revenue the land would be paying, it's 700 millions," said he. And as I looked at his mouth and chin, I was disposed to agree with him. We talked politics, the politics of loaferdom, that sees things from the underside where the lath and plaster is not smoothed off. And we talked postal arrangements, because my friend wanted to send a telegram back from the next station to Ajmer, the turning-off place from the Bombay to the Mau line as you travel westward. My friend had no money beyond 8 annas, which he wanted for dinner, and I had no money at all, owing to the hitch in the budget before mentioned. Further, I was going into a wilderness where, though I should resume touch with the Treasury, there were no telegraph offices. I was therefore unable to help him in any way.
"We might threaten the station master and make him send a wire on tick," said my friend. "But that'd mean inquiries for you and for me, and I've got my hands full these days. Did you say you're travelling back along this line within any days?"
"Within 10," I said.
"Can't you make it 8? Said he.
"Mine is rather urgent business." "I can send your telegram within 10 days, if that will serve you," I said.
"I couldn't trust the wire to fetch him, now I think of it. It's this way. He leaves Delhi on the 23rd for Bombay. That means he'll be running through Ajmer about the night of the 23rd.
"But I'm going into the Indian desert," I explained.
"Well and good," said he. "You'll be changing at Marwar Junction to get into Jodhpur territory. You must do that, and he'll be coming through Marwar Junction in the early morning of the 24th by the Bombay Mail. Can you be at Marwar Junction on that time? 'Twon't be inconveniencing you, because I know that there's precious few pickings to be got out of these central India states, even though you pretend to be correspondent of the Backwoodsman."
"Have you ever tried that trick?" I asked.
"Again and again. But the residents find you out, and then you get escorted to the border before you've time to get your knife into them. But about my friend here, I must give him a word of mouth to tell him what's come to me, or else he won't know where to go.
I would take it more than kind of you if you was to come out of central India in time to catch him at Marwar Junction, and say to him, 'He has gone south for the week.' He'll know what that means. He's a big man with a red beard, and a great swell he is. You'll find him sleeping like a gentleman with all his luggage round him in a second-class compartment. But don't you be afraid. Slip down the window and say, 'He has gone south for the week,' and he'll tumble. It's only cutting your time of stay in those parts by 2 days. I ask you as a stranger, going to the west," he said with emphasis.
"Where have you come from?" said I.
"From the east," said he. "And I'm hoping that you will give him the message on the square, for the sake of my mother, as well as your own." Englishmen are not usually softened by appeals to the memory of their mothers, but for certain reasons, which will be fully apparent, I saw fit to agree.